Welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show. Worldwide, you made us the most popular internet show. Thank you, my audience. Also, welcome Tantalk 1340 AM in Florida and 1400 AM in Florida, the voice of Tampa Bay, Dr. Fred Bell. Tonight we have Randy Masters. Now, Randy is going to be one of the presenters at this show, the Sound Light Healing Center, May 11th and 12th in San Francisco. We're looking forward to lots of you showing up. Randy has been a musician and educator in science and music for many years. He has a unique understanding of harmonic mathematics. And believe me, as a physicist, I've had some great chats with him. Unfortunately, I haven't had enough time to talk to him like I really want to. And he teaches ancient knowledge of Pythagoras and esoteric teaching. Randy is a composer, publisher, multi-talented musician, specializing in world music composition and performance. He taught at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Boy, am I envious of that. And where he was on the music faculty as an artist in residence for 10 years. He also taught 7 years at San Jose State. I don't care if I want to go there or not. It's too far inland. Randy has performed, arranged, and internationally known recording artists as Tito Puente, Charlie Boyd, Hezola Sound is Lou Harrison, and Solar Plexus. Well, welcome to the show, Randy Masters. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Fred. I wanted to get together with you for so many years, and it's just fantastic that this is how we're able to do that.
You know, I've been out of the circuit, off the lectures. You know, I was out there for 30 years, and I spent 20 years in the National Health Federation. Now it's like I have to go back because this Codex Amitrianus thing is the FDA is trying to take over and make all vitamins, you know, under as medicine. And there, and I mean, I have to go back now. But 15 years I've been off the road. I haven't even played a concert in God 10 years. And you know, I'm coming up there to hang out with you guys, and I'm playing my first. I guess I'm playing 9 minutes with Pleiadian Sound, and that I'm really excited. I don't know. It's just like for 15 years I just didn't, you know, want to be around. And it's like these old rock stars that come back. You know, the veteran cosmic rockers. You know, I guess they come back at some point with a new message, and I think I might have a new message. I'm not sure because it sounds like you guys have really, you know, been doing your homework while I've been gone.
So, well, anyhow, I think we go into different spheres of influence, you know, by our calling. And then when we come back together, we bring things into the table that people wouldn't have expected that connect the dots. You know, the whole unified field is improved because of these journeys we go on.
Yeah, I know. I've had, you know, as you know, I've had Tom Kenyon on. I've had Jonathan Goldman on. Now I've got you on. I consider you guys the big three of this whole presentation. I know my old buddy Pat Flanagan, who I haven't talked to in 15 or 20 years.
We see him a lot. He's moving to Sedona again.
Yeah, again. And yeah. I've known this man for some. We've had some great times. We've done some inventing together. He's been great. But anyhow, my audience would like to know a little bit about you. I have a crazy audience, and could you give us? I know you sent me this big long resume, and I didn't want to like read it on the air because it would be boring. I want you to tell the people from where you started, how you got into this, you know, this music business. And a lot of you guys are, you know, you guys, I'm not a very famous musician like some of you guys are. I don't even consider myself a musician in your presence. But, you know, I did get 5 albums out worldwide, which is something. But, look at these guys you played with. I mean, it's amazing, you know. So tell us about your background anyway.
Well, I was an only child, so I could spend a lot of time practicing and started music.
Where are you from? What's your hometown?
Las Vegas, Nevada.
Okay,
and then I
great.
Moved to Sacramento and lived there in Cupertino, and then finally to Santa Cruz in 1964.
Yeah, you had a pretty colorful background, and your family did in Las Vegas, right?
Yeah, it was wild compared to the things that I'm doing now. They're part of the founding fathers of Las Vegas. And, I was born into having entertainment and music and sound on a certain public level, but then I had all of these other directives that have higher mathematics and codes that eventually had to have their time to come through. So in the beginning years, I became a classical musician and a jazz musician and taught jazz music and taught songwriting.
Jazz field. Pardon me for butting in because I'm a jazz freak, but I used to be. When did you get into the jazz field? Exactly when? What year?
When I was in the sixth grade, I was taking
lessons.
So that
would be what year?
Oh, yeah. Oh, let's see. I probably started kindergarten probably about 1955, graduated from high school in 64, so counting back from there.
Yeah.
And then
well, that, I mean that's when jazz was really a heartbeat in this country, I feel.
Absolutely. I love improvising. And
yeah.
So I studied that very intensely and studied the piano, the guitar, trumpet, bass, played a lot of different instruments, and always had my own groups. I started playing professionally in high school and always had my own groups and wrote music for my groups as well. And then later on, I got to play with a number of luminaries like Tito Puente and Cal Jader and Charlie Bird.
Cal Jader was to die for.
We had such a great time. What's fascinating to me, and I don't know that I understand it all, other than it probably fits into, you know, why we're connecting so deeply and talking and why I didn't go that path more. But a number of the luminaries that I wrote for and played for all passed away before we could put out an album. Tito Puente did, Cal Jader did, Charlie Bird did, also the organ player Walter Wanderley from Brazil.
Well, I was thinking guitar under Wes Montgomery when he was around, because he was a friend of Leo Fender's, and that's how I met him.
I loved Wes Montgomery, was one of my guitar idols, and Kenny Burrell.
Yeah, me. Yeah,
all
awesome.
Of that soulful stuff, and I was way into it. But what happened somewhere along the line in the 60s, early 60s, I got into the Brazilian music, and somehow something lit up so big that became Brazilian music that then led into Puerto Rican and Cuban and Caribbean and African. And I started studying and really mastering the music in these different cultures so I could compose fluently in that style, even if I didn't speak their native language. I trained myself to be able to compose fluently in their style. The group Hejoli Sounds from Ghana used to be with Hugh Masekela, the Grazing in the Grass trumpet player.
My God, yeah, I remember Hugh very well.
So I played with him, with Hejoli for 15 years. I was the only non-Ghanaian member of the band, and it was a blast. It changed. What I felt from all these cultures was the amount of soul and love and connectivity and the love of life. It's in their foods, it's in their spices, the colors they wear, their smile, and that really caught me. So I didn't focus on going the bebop route in jazz, and my thing became international jazz music. And did a couple of movie scores where I wrote Italian music and another one I wrote all Latin American music for a political film on El Salvador called The Situation.
Wow. That's
and then
really cool.
Lou Harrison lived around the corner from me. He created the Cabrillo Music Festival, and he was one of the 20th century's most prolific composers that embraced world cultures, especially the Asian cultures. And he also embraced unusual tuning systems in his music, and he only lived a couple blocks from me. So
wow.
I ended up recording with his gamelan and playing, and he had his specialty in music that was based on whole number ratios in the tuning systems rather than equal temperament, and that's something that became a specialty for me. And little by little, I began to take that into the sciences and look at things in science from a musician's point of view, and I began to see harmonic things that I wasn't hearing that anybody else had observed, and yet they were obvious. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, I know the special signatures. I've tuned some of my synthesizers to different send tones to different scales that are more like Eastern music and stuff. And I really enjoyed that. It just unfortunately, it's a lot of work to do it, and I didn't have the time to really get into that. But I commend you for what you've done there. You know.
Well, there's certain emotions that when you tune correct in with certain ratios, that the emotions that the intervals provide are different than ones in a fixed system like in equal temperament. And when I worked with Ashwin Batish from India, he was demonstrating to me on the sitar how he could slightly move the frets on the sitar, changing the interval, and like a simple interval like a major third, like a C up to a E natural, for instance, would all of a sudden either be darker or brighter, and there'd be an emotion that you couldn't get that emotion unless you had the interval right.
Yeah,
and it was fascinating.
I understand that. You know, where I don't know if I had discussed this with you off air or not, but I was a contactee of this lady Sumyasi from the Pleiades back in '71, and she came here.
Oh yes.
And I did some paintings with her. They're hanging on the wall and they're on live camera. Some people right now watching the show probably clicked on the website. I apologize for my birds. Normally they're quiet, but since you came on, they got excited, and they'll get quiet in a little bit as the sun goes up. But anyway, she told me that the sitar came, you know, was brought here by the Rishis, which were the people from the Pleiades 26,000 years ago, and it had the harmonic intonations or the timbre to raise consciousness. And then she told me about, you know, the players doing the ragas, different ragas start out certain vibrations and reach another level. And then I used to have a guy that lived with me. His name was Warren. He actually wrote a song called "Don't Bogart the Joint," but he was actually a sitar player with Ravi Shankar. He was an American here, a friend.
Oh,
of mine,
I remember that
Ravi.
Song. Yeah.
Yeah, and I used to get up in the morning, in my other house in Laguna, and the sun is coming up. It's like 6:30 in the morning. He's got the incense going. We're both vegetarians. We don't drink. We don't smoke. And he's playing this beautiful sitar music. It's like I wake up to that, and it's, oh my God, I'm in heaven. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Well,
that was my extreme exquisite taste for the sitar. I just love that instrument. I've sampled it, and I play it a lot off samples, but it's not like the real thing, you know, obviously.
Well, we're doing a sound recording with Jan Sircone, the singer, teaches up there, and she'll be up there at the conference, the May 11th through 14th conference, and she teaches sacred sound and healing, and we're doing a very unusual sound recording, and we worked with Mark Deutsch, who invented an instrument called the Bazantar, where he took an acoustic bass and put these large sympathetic sitar strings on it. And the harmonics,
wow.
And it's out of this world. It's got to be one of the richest sounding instruments I have ever heard in my life. You just have to play one note and the whole house is filled with undertones and overtones. It's awesome.
Wow. That's like
And he's patented it, called Bazantar. And he told me a story that he had played it for Quincy Jones, and Quincy did not believe that that could be done live, that was not done with overdubbing or something. In other words, just plain live.
Yeah, no,
with no treatment.
Yeah.
And I believe a lot of the secrets of the sound is, like you say on your tapes too, is in the timbre and the harmonic content of the tone. And a lot of sound healers, I think, and other people working with sound in different sacred ways and in popular ways as well, that includes all styles of music, don't get into tone and sound deep enough to know what the real magic of tone quality can do for the consciousness and for the music, to where you play one note and it's so beautiful you don't even have to play anything else, and a world of great beauty is invoked.
Yeah, that's. But I'm gonna show it from an electronic standpoint, thanks to Semyasti, because I have these programs that I mixed with the Pleiadian ships on my D50 through a D50 command program. Luckily, I got a lot of backups because I even sat down in because it was done on a computer with their stuff and my stuff, and I came up with these series of sounds which I'm bringing up to the conference, which if I ever lost them, I could never duplicate them again. Luckily, I have backups and cards, you know what I mean, ROM cards stored with these sounds. And
yeah.
I understand, and to me, a synthesizer, I've been into those for a long time. I'm, you know, as you know, I'm a reed player, I'm a clarinet, but
yeah.
Sax, but I mean, I was never able to get out of an electronic instrument. I thought what I could get out of, you know, what I could get you on your trumpet or a clarinet and or a bagpipe, you know, and this synthesizer sound is amazing. It's amazing. And I just love to hear the sitar thing you're talking about, because I think I like to jam with this guy.
Oh, no problem at all. He'll be up there at the conference. It's Mark Deutsch, and it's called the Bazantar, Bazantar. And
well,
we'll have these recordings, and he'll be there with that instrument.
Are you bringing any of your horns up there at all?
I actually haven't been playing my horn since 98. I've been so deep in all of this world of the science of sound and sacred geometry and things that I do, that I took a break, and I didn't think it was going to be this long from playing, and so
yeah.
I don't know what it's going to take to get me back there.
I'll bring my clarinet.
You know, I have a sound physicist friend that taught electronic music at UC Santa Cruz. I've known for 30 years, Bob Hoover. He invents speaker systems that don't have any kind of distortion in them. And they're really unusual. And he was telling me how he could build tones on the synthesizer with certain kind of mathematic and harmonic knowledge that would make them as beautiful as acoustic sounds. And I never really thought that the electronic tones could go there, but I have over the years found that with the right knowledge of harmonics and how you put that together, that we can actually create tones that are live and full of life force and vibrant electronically. And I think that the key to it is in that harmonic world. And I'd love to analyze more deeply those Pleiadian sounds. When I initially looked at their fundamental, that, like, say, I think you said it was about 1,000 hertz fundamental, and I divided that down by octaves, once you get down to 250 hertz, that and one octave lower, 125 hertz, are found all over the Giza pyramid when they've done sound and analysis studies of the acoustic chambers in the pyramid. That specific note shows up a lot of the time, 125 hertz. It also shows up in the analysis at Stonehenge. And then when you divide that those notes down several more octaves, you get 7.8125, the Schumann resonance. So my sense is the reason that note is part of the ship sound is because they're tuning to our brainwave for the planet. Does that make sense to you with what you know about it?
Yeah, we're back on the air now. Are you there, Randy?
That's great.
Go ahead. If you don't mind repeating that last little statement about the what you were talking about with the with those instruments, and then we'll go from there.
Well, one thing, the last thing I was talking about was how that 1,000 hertz, now, was that something you'd like me to comment on?
Yeah. Go ahead. We're talking about the Pleiadian ship resonating.
Yeah, and having that 1,000 hertz tone that you found in your analyzing that.
Right.
And I was mentioning that when you step that down by two a number of times and octavize it down, you get 250 hertz. And then an octave lower, 125 hertz. And both of those frequencies are found in like four places in the Giza Pyramid, the King's Chamber, Queen's Chamber, the Grand Gallery, and also at Stonehenge. And when Don Estes did analysis of people's voices, over 3,000 people, and then they crunched the numbers in a supercomputer, they found that most humans shared the 125 and 250 hertz note. And
right.
And then when you go lower, by octaves down, you get 7.8125 exactly, and I believe that that's the Schumann resonance baseline, that it varies from that and moves up, but I believe that that's the baseline, and perhaps the Palladian chips and the pyramids and Stonehenge and what we share in our voice all have this linking tone, and that's a very unifying thought to think about.
Yeah, you know, what happened with Semyasi when she gave me these sounds that I'm going to bring up there and some others that I won't bring, she told me that if I took this, because I've taken my synthesizer out in the field, the D50, I've taken it to Dulce, New Mexico, and I had the Indians, the Hickory Apaches play it, and but Archuleta Mesa, and the ships came out of the ground. We filmed them for a magazine called UFO Review, actually coming out of the ground, and because the sounds will invoke these energies, and she said that someday I would, you know, it's all battery power. It's a really trick stuff that we built. And she said someday we go to Egypt, we could open up some chambers, preferably in the Dendora Temple, which is down the Nile from.
Yeah, I've been to that temple. Uh-huh, absolutely.
The one with the Pleiades on the ceiling, yeah. So
well,
hopefully
I,
someday I'll get a chance to do that. It looks to me like now that my life has turned around where I can actually probably do that one of these days. You know, BBS Radio is going to be launching a television crew to do documentaries. A sci-fi channel wanted to work with me because I used to work with a Bigfoot down in Joe Brown Howard in Arkansas, but I wouldn't go down there because I had really good communication with this Bigfoot, and I wouldn't go down there with the sci-fi film crew because I didn't want to desecrate his area. I didn't want tourists coming
right
into this sacred area. You understand? So
absolutely.
I held off on some of this with commercial channels, but with BBS Radio, because I'm one of the owners of the station, we're going to be doing this stuff pretty soon. You can come along and have some fun with us, too, if you want, you know.
Well, that would be wonderful. And I'm sure that the experiences that you had where you went through the bardos and things in the Himalayas in handling, you know, the death fears and clearing that from your field would allow you to communicate with a Bigfoot, and they wouldn't feel any fear in your field.
They didn't, and I had to take a Tibetan ceremony out on the Mojave Desert when I was 33, and that's like 30 years ago, and it's the same thing as the Indian rattlesnake ceremony.
Yes,
where they
I understand
put you
that.
In a viper pit, but instead the Tibetans gave me a strychnine. It's the same thing, out in the desert. I had to take strychnine, enough to kill about 50 people, and I had to survive it. I wrote about it in my book, Death of Ignorance. After that, I had a different attitude on life.
Yeah.
It's a long story. I'll tell you in person sometime, but after that,
would you call it a near-life experience?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, first of
all, compared to a near-death experience, a near-life experience.
Well, you know, real briefly, I was trained. I had to be I'm a vegetarian, and I was a vegetarian then, and I had to be a fruitarian for a year because this poison they told me would kill me if I was any poisons in my body. It would be an additive process and kill me. So the first day that I had this in my system, I was blind. I couldn't see anything. It made me blind. I could not see. And I had to run across this desert completely naked in a hot sun and sense where the rocks were and everything in order to get enough prana going in my system to get my vision back. And then when I got my vision back, it was at night, and I sat down and had to do fire breathing like thousands. I still do it. I do it every day. I do Kundalini yoga, have for years. And I did all this fire breathing. And then I passed out. I had this nirvanic experience like on the second day. And the third day, when I woke up, and everything was the poison was out of my system. I was laying in the hot sun on a Sunday afternoon in the middle of the Mojave Desert, completely naked, on an anthill, a red anthill about 6 feet tall, laid out, spread eagle on this anthill, and these big red ants, about an inch and a half long, were crawling around me.
Wow.
And then I came back. I had to walk 20 miles back to where the thing started to get my clothes. So I mean, that was when I was 33, and you know, and it's like, I don't talk about that much, but it really happened, you know. I got to see something. I don't know, you know. I saw, I guess, the other side. It gave me a hell of a lot of confidence. I didn't have a fear of death after that. That's for darn sure, you know. You wake up with those big old ants crawling around you.
Well, I sat on an anthill in Las Vegas where I was born, and when I was maybe 3 years old, and you know, I had a different kind of experience. They didn't necessarily go around me, but I'm sure I had one of my first Kundalini experiences.
Yeah, those fire ants.
Those little red ants, you know.
Yeah,
it didn't handle all the death fears at that time, but you know, I'm taking it in process here.
No, that's, we call those fire ants, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, I've heard what those are.
I do. I absolutely know what those are. You know, mentioned the 25,820.5 year Palladian orbit. In,
right,
in
right.
A lot
we're
of different
6,827 is the same as the ratio of the Great Pyramid in pyramid inches, and the same as the ratio of the carbon atom in the body. We're made up of oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, and carbon. So anyhow, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I worked with that number and took it through a lot of different formulas because I had studied with Wes Bateman. We had done a project. It was about a 28-year study. I did about 12 to 15 years studying all the measurements of the Giza Plateau and a number of other Mayan sites, every single measurement in every one of those pyramids. And in that work, I discovered not only a geometric matrix, but a total musical matrix that was in that. And then I started looking at other things in science from what I had learned looking into the pyramid. And based
right.
on that particular value of rotation, I calculated a cubit of exactly 20.662 inches, and that's not rounding it off or cutting it off or anything. That's the full value that would completely address 25,827.5 years. I have certain formulas that I found in checking all the different cubits and measurements and what they were, why there were the links they were, and trying to find out what they could be used for.
You came out with the same numbers I did then.
Yeah. Then there's a few different formulas I discovered of Palladian version of pi that answers to the same number. And again, I'm using all of these formulas that I confirm through comparing it to what I've learned harmonically from about the hydrogen atom and the hydrogen molecule, studying
yeah,
the harmonic.
Before we get into that, let me just go into something here because we get a whole hour and a half. We got a whole hour to go. Okay, when Semyazi explained this to me, first of all, we had a little chat about France and the metric system and how the metric system was introduced basically through the oil industry, you know, into our society to make things look bigger, you know, like so many liters cost so many marks in Germany for gas. And she explained
yeah.
all that to me. It was just based on greed, basically. The metric system has no conformity to any Earth terrestrial measurements, number
Absolutely.
One.
Absolutely.
Yeah, number two, the our inch and the pyramid inch are within about, I don't know, a few thousandths of an inch, the one going around the base of the pyramid.
Yes.
Or exactly. anywhere, the cubic, you know, not the cubit, but the actual pyramidical inch.
Yes.
So then she said, imagine, you know, she told me life is a spiral. I mean, I know you know this, but life is a spiral. It doesn't complete, you know, insanity is when it becomes a circle and you're trying to get the...
I 100% agree.
Yeah, so it's a cycle.
It becomes entropic then instead of syntropic.
Exactly. So, you know, you high-tech guys are great. So anyway, going up, you know, and the body's made of oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, and carbon, okay? Okay, nitrogen makes protein. Oxygen is the animator for prana. Hydrogen is an atom of consciousness. And then the carbon atom is the way it threads into the consciousness. In other words, the hydrogen atom has to deliver pranically an energy system into the carbon atom, which then goes into our genetic structure, making genes, DNA, you know, and the DNA process. Well, as we move around the Pleiades, we get a higher signal vibration, I would say signal of consciousness, signal of ignorance ratio, as we go around the Pleiades. And so as a result, our consciousness starts to spiral up the Great Pyramid in Egypt, as per the prophecies of 2013, and in our bodies, we become more aware of God and God within us and higher forces and all these kinds of things, and we start to, our synapses in our brain start firing faster. We can now see beyond the normal, you know, spectrum of 400 to 700 angstrom units in the, you know, in our normal visual. We can go beyond that, preferably towards ultraviolet where there's more secrets. And she said, as we move around the Pleiades, this becomes more and more enhanced. And this is how it was explained to me about 30 years ago, and it's totally cool, you know. And so now you come along, and you've been working on the hydrogen atom, which is my favorite, you know.
Mine too.
Yeah, with all the numbers you sent me, which I have here, which I might, you know, I'll explain that to you later, what I'm going to do with some of those. But, I mean, it's really cool because now you're verifying what I have already learned about, and you're taking it somewhere else, which is even better. So with that opening, you go ahead on the hydrogen atom, okay?
Well, you know, the scientists' reported values and a lot of different things are not always accurate because equipment jitters and wiggles or something in their formula was slightly off. And so the Balmer constant that they used for determining the visible spectral lines of hydrogen, named after John Jacob Balmer,
right,
who discovered those in the late 1800s and all, they didn't have the right Balmer constant. But when you put the right constant in there,
right,
I got I went through and did all 34 of the Balmer spectral lines. That means 34 visible lines, one red, one cyan blue, and one of them is like a blue-violet. And all the other 31 lines are all violet lines,
right,
that are all visible. That's significant.
Butterfly. I always tell people a butterfly sees down into ultraviolet, which is where the astral plane is. That's the doorway there, whereas a, you know, a fly or a, you know, some aggravating insect sees an infrared. So ultraviolet, you know, we sell these 402 nanometer blue lasers, and I sold them for years. I used to get them. They were very expensive before they came solid state. They're still pretty high because we used those in meditation with our crystals and pyramid systems. That was the doorway. We found that out a long time ago. So it just confirms, you know, from our point of making actual products to what you're talking about, which is great.
Well, I could give you a hydrogen value for that laser that ties into your research and mine and puts exact numbers on it if you would like.
Yeah.
Either, you know, sometime whenever you want to talk about that, I've calculated.
I'm going to hang out with you up there in San Francisco.
Because there's a lot of things.
I don't want to lose my audience if we get too technical here.
Yeah, I don't want to lose them because the thing is in discovering all this, because I was a musician. I wrote intuitively, even though I had the theoretical training, but I don't forget about the heart and putting that in the driver's seat.
For a second. Now, you started out, let's say you started out in music.
Right.
Were you doing science with music when you were a kid or what?
I was good in the sciences, but at a certain point, just practicing every day and writing music absorbed everything but eating and sleeping. In order to maintain the instruments I played and the level that I wanted to go to and the knowledge.
You were amazing, what you did instrument-wise.
So I didn't have time for that. But
like
when I got back into the science, it happened through certain subtle energy discoveries, and I began to do the engineering for a company called Spring Life that has some polarizers that work off of minerals. And I started designing resonant cavities for those mineral formulas based on sacred geometry and wavelengths. And more and more that I got into this and into sacred geometry, the science part of me clicked into gear and took over. It became like a new instrument, and I had to bring...
When you started doing that?
Well, I was very intensely in the 80s.
Okay.
Before that, I probably wouldn't have cared about it at all. I mean, peripherally.
Well, you had something happened in your life, you had a massive transition.
Well, and it seems like a lot of doors in music were not open the way they were before, where I just go and make an album, but done deal, and I'd look back and say, well, how did I do that? And it'd be over. All of a sudden, I'd give recordings to people in record companies, and they'd never open it, or nothing would happen. And the doors in sacred geometry.
The music shut for a while.
It did, and it was frustrating. But given the intensity that I devoted to all of this, I couldn't understand it. And the sacred geometry door blew over. The authors of books started calling me. I didn't have to audition like you would audition in music.
I know.
They literally called me up and wanted to.
Right. So, yeah, Randy, I just got to tell you something. Your life is just the opposite of mine. I was a scientist, MK Ultra, CIA kid growing up, and this went on until 1988. And I was working with David Tickle. I mean, David Tickle was my mentor, and you know, he was producing like Sting and U2 and all those bands, and Elton John, all of them. And all of a sudden, I sat down. I went out and bought me an 8-track tape recorder. Now this is 1988. I don't know how old I was. It was probably, I don't know, late 30s, early 40s. And I went out and I made this album called Fellowship the Sound. And the idea, I had a deal with Doubleday because I had a book out, Brad Steiger had written, and we were going to slap this little tape on this rock opera that I wrote on top of a book and sell it. But then they changed editors, and then the thing got flushed down the toilet. The book came out, but the music wasn't on it. That was 88 for me.
Now, I've heard that recording. I love that.
Yeah, and the stupid damn thing ended up in the Cannes Film Festival 2 years in a row, this little album on an 8-track recorder. It got stunning reviews, and it was in a pile of European movies. They used different songs in European movies. That was like, then I went over to Germany in 91, and recorded the Galactic Meditation with this guy that did on a Sony. We recorded Galactic Meditation on a Sony DAT deck with one channel full of fuzz with a guy named Werner Ahrens. It sold a quarter of a million. A company picked it up, you know, a record company, screwed up on a 2-track Sony DAT recorder and sold a quarter of a million, fixed the bad channel, you know, somehow, and it sold a quarter of a million copies. That launched my music career. Then I went out and played concerts all over Europe and had spaceships come to my concerts. It's just like the reverse of what you're doing. I mean, I'm not the musician you are. You are incredible as a musician. I've never played with bands like you have. I'll never be there. I don't have the time for it. But I got my feet wet with it, and I'm seeing now you're going to be probably more scientific than I am. I see you can surpass, you know, surpass me in science. I'm excited.
Well, that's what's so exciting about the science is that, you know, it shows a loving, harmonically intelligent, unified field with music operating and sound operating everywhere. And you go back to phrases like, in the beginning was the sound or was the word, and that sound, to me, generates the reality. And light appears in there so you can see the reality, and the sound current and the light currents are working together, and there's a way that geometrical shapes and sound and light, those three components are all working together. So I've been massively studying light. I've been studying the acoustics and sound and different properties of sound and sacred geometry. And pretty soon there's a dialogue that I'm listening to that I can hear talking. And it's not left brain. I would love the readers to feel this and what I'm saying. And I'm sorry if they felt lost with any of the technical discussion. But the
I got some very high-tech people living. You can get really deep. We won't listen. There's too many. We're all over the world in many countries. There's a lot of people out there. I got a lot of scientists listening to this, believe me. But
well, I could say to the scientists, and I could also say to those who aren't that might consider a lot of this stuff could be left brain, that we're talking about celestial creation codes of mathematics and geometry and light and color and sound and specific numbers that are flowing through the unified field. And when I work with that stuff, there's so much love that you feel in creation that as I'd work with my calculator, I wouldn't even turn sounds on in the background to keep me busy. I had total silence for hours at a time. I wouldn't eat, wouldn't need to sleep as much. And my calculator became, for a number of years, my number one musical instrument. And I got to the point where, and I wrote all of this stuff out by hand. I didn't put it into the computer by typing, nor typewriters or spreadsheets. I did every single number, millions of numbers, all by hand with a lead pencil. So I feel what it did is I traced those numbers as a pattern, and those vibrations from the lead came from the lead pencil on the paper, drawing the numbers, put those vibrations back into my body, and it literally changed things in my consciousness doing this, what would look like laborious work of doing all these numbers to all the decimal points that I could accommodate on my calculator. I never rounded them up or cut them off or anything. I'd always write it all the way out. And by being in that field, I got into a place that's more like the stories of Beethoven when he's supposedly deaf, you know, and we know you hear from more than our ears, but he's writing music. I felt like I could hear the music of the spheres and these numbers, and I could see all of these magical numbers talking, and I was listening in on a private conversation with the creator forces about how they use these things to create reality with. And that's where I went with it.
Yeah. Now, let me. The thing is, I got you on the phone. You don't have my Rays of Truth book, right? Or you do?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I love that book. I want to come back to a hydrogen molecule comment you made and a discovery I made because of your book.
What was that?
Well, you gave a very nice description of jet lag and what happens in the hydrogen molecule polarity from red in the morning.
The polarity shift to the chakras and the atom and the cells in the body. Yeah, I understand. Go ahead.
And the violet in the evening when the sun goes down, and then, of course,
let me just stop you there. Listeners, what I say is what Randy is talking about is in the morning you get up, you have one set of feelings. At midnight, you have another. You're sorting out at midnight what you went through the day, and in the morning you're starting your day out. And he's talking about that. Go ahead. Yeah.
So I was teaching one of my classes, and all of a sudden I was telling him about this because of the things I was doing with hydrogen, and I stopped right in the middle of class. I had the blackboard up there, and I worked all the math on the board right then. I converted the hydrogen line of red and violet, which are in a phi ratio, exactly 8 to 5, 1.6, the two of them, as a musical golden mean ratio between the red to the violet. And this red line is in the rainbow when the light from the sun goes through a quartz prism and splits into 9 rays. There's 2 reds, one dark red and one that has a little orange. That one with a little orange is the Balmer red line of hydrogen. And then I was looking for the phi ratio in there, so I took one of the violet lines from the Balmer line, and then I added those two together and divided it by 2, so I made an arithmetic mean of red plus violet divided by 2 equals green. And
right.
To create the green in this, because there are no green spectral lines of hydrogen yet, by averaging the red and the violet, it produces a green. And the ratios between those two link up with sacred geometry on a 1 to 5 squared divided by 2 to phi ratio. I mean, it couldn't be better than that.
You know, when I got into lasers, I was working with Mel's Grit long before I was New Age. I had an electronics company in those older days. All the old lasers, they always had this tube, and they had a gas in it. You could have a red laser, you could have a green laser, a helium cadmium, which is a violet laser, or you could have an argon laser, which is a green laser. To get the laser to work before solid state, you had to fire off at this tube with a gas in it, a xenon white light flash tube. Regardless of what color came out of that laser, the laser gases only absorbed the green part of the spectrum. Then from that, they would produce a violet light or a green light or a blue light or a red light. But it was always exactly, you know, it's so funny how you discovered that. And that's what physics had done with the old gas lasers, which were around for a long time, since the 60s when Hughes Aircraft developed the first one.
That's green.
That's
like a pivot point.
Yeah, it's a pivot point. And it's nature. You know,
and with these colors, and I do want to get to the place where I can supply these numbers for precisely tuning lasers to this knowledge so that the light and the sound immaculately link up. So they're not sort of the same, not like a sort of green, but the exact green. Well, when I did this process, and you convert it to sound, the green sound frequency is like 255.9 and a whole bunch of other decimals. Literally rounding that up, you'd get 256 C. It shows how through hydrogen, a middle C of 256 hertz actually makes sense in the physics of it all.
Yeah, that's the center of the piano. That's the center of music. Isn't that amazing? Yeah, that's a great point.
And it's not some other C. It's
the
not
first
like
note any musician ever plays on, whatever they're learning in school, is always C. Here's C. Here's where we start.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah,
not
most
A,
of the time.
Not A, but C, yeah.
Even though we reference to this A440, which produces
I know. Everybody learns C. Middle C is where you start. Really? Yeah. That's great. I didn't know that. I rethought about it that way. That's great.
The way I had had a certain reverence for that C note was because basically that's just a multiple of 2 hertz, and then it'll break down to unity. So I compare all phenomena in any that I get in sciences or anything back to multiples of 2 hertz to see where on an octave scale would this phenomena lie. And I octavize everything, so I have this octave of all the known reality all put into an octave. Yeah. And that helps me know musically, whereas anything that I hear about, I immediately translate it into music, put it into a musical scale, and I know the name of the note, where it is, and how it relates to everything else. And it's enabled me to memorize tons of numbers and call them up when I need to in order to be efficient and not have to go digging through some file cabinet in my mind or elsewhere.
Yeah.
It's really helped.
Do you ever come to Southern California much?
Pardon me?
Do you ever come to Southern California much?
I'm hearing
that. Where I live in Laguna Beach. Do you ever come down this way much?
We're getting a distortion. I'm not able to hear.
I'm sorry.
Well, somehow.
Can you hear me now?
There's an echoey distortion.
Yeah, something is going on with. He's got a lot of new equipment up there. I can hear you perfectly.
Yeah, and you're like in an echo with a distorted quality right now.
Yeah, you're at least it's going out clear. Can you understand me okay or not?
Barely.
Okay, hold on.
Something changed.
Yeah, no, it's coming off on the air fine. I don't know. Let me just go to the handset. Hold on. Does this help any better?
A little bit, yes.
Okay, I just went to a different thing here. Do you ever come to Southern California at all, Laguna Beach?
With the echo, it's difficult. I'll do my best.
Yeah, hopefully it'll correct itself. Because it's coming out perfect on the air. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Yeah.
Okay. Do you ever come to Laguna Beach?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
Okay, because what I want to do is have you come down here. Remember I told you about that levitation thing? It's in the book with the 60-50s?
Yes.
I want to demonstrate that energy to you, and maybe, you know, you can mathematically pick up on it. I want to try to bring all of those sounds with me up to San Francisco, but there'll only be 1D50. I need 6 to do what I do with that to make that thing work, but I have 6 different variations of one sound that I was able to make this happen. It's really interesting.
Can you store it up in laptops, in computer synthesizer programs in a laptop?
Well, I probably could, but I've never done that. You know, I'm not as advanced on the computer. Now, when it comes to programming a synthesizer, no problem, because I've been doing it for years. But when it comes to getting it, you know, into a laptop, playing a sound into it, I'm not that good at it. I mean, I can do it, but I mean, I'd have to show you this stuff. I just can't. I'm limited.
I'm not real strong in that part, but I have friends who are, and I just assemble the team members I need when we come up against something.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we can get all the team members there to put together any particular configuration to make it happen.
Yeah, because when Semyasi taught me about their beam ships, which I wrote about in my book, she told me they were sound-powered and light-separated. You know, it's like, you know, so many people think of light being broken down and blah, blah, blah. No, it's sound. They break down sound, and they separate light out of sound. They go the other way with it, and they produce this image around the ship, and that's how it moves. And it was, like, completely different from all these idiots that always profane to know how these systems work. The other thing I want to tell you about, did you read in the book about the S-curved flute?
Yeah, where 2 people play it.
Yeah, looking at each other, doing a traspasso.
I know what that. Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah, she demonstrated that once. A left eye to a left eye. Okay.
Okay.
In this, and you have to. And I'm just learning to play the flute. I've got one right here, a really nice one, and I've been working on it for 3. Well, I'm in my 3rd year with it now, and it's starting to play better. You know, but I mean, it's not. I mean, you know, when I was touring with the Moody Blues, we had the. You know, Ray Thomas was like this brilliant flute player. You have to have 2 of him, you know, playing against each other perfectly in all perfect pitch and timber, and this light snakes out around you. It's just like it just snakes out. It's like it, across the room. It's just like opens up. It's like a laser, but it doesn't have a direction. It's not going in a straight line. It just moves around. It's beautiful.
Oh, well,
and she demonstrated that once, and it's like, wow, I think we'll get there someday. You know?
Did an instrument like that ever get played in the Earth's atmosphere or down here on Earth, or was it only on a ship or elsewhere?
No, I think it's been played here.
I wonder what some of those instruments.
She showed me on a ship, but I mean, I think it's been done here. I haven't had the time to really go after that. You know, she probably downloaded it my DNA somewhere, and I could probably search it out more. But I, you know, you got to sit down and work with something like that. You know, it takes some time.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know,
the unity of breath, and there's different kinds of breathing techniques that can actually activate cellular movement. As you know, certainly lots of gurus and rishis and different spiritual practices teach different breathing, but some of them can actually be applied in a musical situation, I believe, the right kind of breathing to activate the consciousness in such a way to allow you to go into exceptional places and play music rather than more the mundane or ones where simple virtuosic technique and background is getting you through. I think there's some other realms where the breathing synchronized with the sound actually will create something that's very exceptional.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's, you know, I've been playing the clarinet since sixth grade, and I did take a 20-year break, but it doesn't really matter anymore because I got it, picked it back up. I always played Buffet Crompton clarinets. I got the R13. I've even got a 1929 one, an antique that plays beautifully. I had it all redone. And then I got a hold of this flute, you know, and it's also a Buffet flute, which is kind of rare in this country. And I started playing it and playing it and playing it. First, I couldn't get a damn sound out of it. That was And I used to go on Art Bell and play the clarinet. George Norio would play the clarinet. And I tried to play the flute one night on Art Bell, and it didn't work too well because I was too nervous. But you know what I mean? It just doesn't cooperate when I want it to with the sound. But once I get the sound coming out of it, you can do so much with that with a flute. I mean, well, you're a trumpet player. It's the same thing. You know, like I told you, I wanted to play trumpet, and I tried out in sixth grade, and I had the crooked teeth. I had since had them fixed, but, you know, the guy, I really wanted to play a trumpet. I really wanted to play it so bad, and the guy stuck a trumpet up, and he looked at my teeth, and he says, "You're not going to play trumpet." And I says, "You got to be kidding. I am a trumpet player." And he says, "Blow it." And I couldn't get a damn sound out of it.
Well, I didn't really necessarily want to play trumpet because when I was born, my right arm was paralyzed, and I could only use my right hand as far as a trumpet to help hold it up.
Yeah.
And, you know, play with like one finger on my right hand when I play my right hand part of my piano. So the trumpet I could hold and play left-handed and hold with my right hand. So almost by default, I got there. And I always wanted to play flute, but my other fingers weren't working.
Yeah.
So on all my recordings, I write massively for flutes and bass flutes and alto flutes. I just think it's one of the primordial instruments along with the harp and the drum and the voice are and certain stringed instruments that eventually evolved into the harp are really the archetype musical instruments. And a trumpet, like blowing through a conch shell, is also one of those archetypes.
Yeah, no, it is. And that's like a rangoon in Tibet. I think that's a rangoon, right? That's one of the things they use for levitation. And I bought my girlfriend a harp because she's a bass player, acoustic bass player. But I bought this harp. But, man, tuning that, just a big one, it's like 5 feet tall. Damn, those things are hard to tune. They don't stay tuned very long. You get it, you know, I guess you got to break in. You tune it and let it sit for 6 months and tune it again. And eventually, after a year goes by, I guess the harp will work. That's the only thing I've been able to come up with, you know.
Well, your girlfriend would love the Bazantar because you do everything you can do on a bass, plus all these sympathetic sitar strings and special pickups and things built into it to make sure you capture it. And then we do very unusual tuning. So it's got five strings, and all the strings are not even tuned in the regular way, so that the harmonics you're playing are different whole number ratio overtone and undertone excerpts. So you get the most magnificent scales that really nail the emotional quality that you want to achieve. They don't get fuzzy.
Does he sell these things?
He has the patent, and they can make them. And he'll be up there at the sound conference, so I'll introduce you.
Yeah,
and because it'd be perfect for what you're doing to have that instrument in with the mix, especially with the Palladian sounds and the Bazantar together would be phenomenal.
Yeah, I think I need one of those. I think that's what I need, Bazantar.
When you hear it, you'll know it's just extraordinary.
We used to have a dulcimer guy here in Laguna Beach. He was out there in the Cannon. He was pretty world famous. Made dulcimers for a long time. Remember, he come up here to the house and play his latest ones. He used to have a lot of musicians come up here and jam in my living room, you know, years ago when I was jamming and stuff. And I mean, the dulcimer was a cute little thing. You know, it didn't do what this bizarre thing does, but...
Pythagoras and other ones taught all the deep things about music, because to me, the understandings of the universe come through understanding music.
Yeah.
I was curious on working with these hydrogen tones that I did with the red, the violet, and the green. I made tuning forks and sound tubes that are like 2-inch diameter sound tubes with it. Would you suspect that one could, if they had jet lag, reset their field with the proper use of these kinds of tuning forks?
Yeah.
In other words, could they reset the hydrogen molecule using the sound equivalent of that light and then have the jet lag just completely reverse?
Yeah, because, you know, jet lag, we didn't really get into it, but it's a situation where the hydrogen atom loses its polarity field focus. And a real crude way of example would be voice accents. For example, I'm from Boston and I have a beer, or I'm from down south and I reckon I'll go down and get my pokes out. You know, it's like all these different accents that people pick up on the magnetic intonations of the ground level vibrations that affect your hydrogen atoms, and they create different accents from Boston to New York to the south to out here in California.
That's fascinating.
In Canada, the Canadians, it's the same thing. And what happens is that connecting faculty, I'm just making this simple for people who don't understand where we're at, that connecting faculty, when you get on a plane from New York and fly to Germany, your whole complete orientation is shot. And what used to bug me the most is the astral body, doesn't it? The astral body used to take me about a week to catch up with me, so that means the ultraviolet frequency would be the last one to finally get in synchronization before I could play music. When I'd go on tour over there, I wouldn't play for 2 weeks. I had trouble practicing, and then it would come. I didn't feel it. You know what? I don't know if you understand what I'm saying, but I think you do.
Yeah.
I couldn't feel what I was supposed to do. I only play by feeling. I don't play by sound so much. I play by the feeling. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that feeling just wouldn't come, so it sounded flat. I mean, I could hear all the notes, but, you know, the attack, just wasn't there.
Well,
I don't know if that makes sense to you or not, but it was my reality, you know. It still is.
Well, I hadn't heard it described that way, nor that aspect of language. I've always been fascinated by accents and what that really is and what the signature of the accents are. I know in a lot of the Tamanist work, they studied in the Iran language, I think, he talks about different frequency bands. So if you spoke fluent French but you were from England, you would be speaking French, but your frequency band you'd be speaking in would be different, and there's a mismatch that takes place. Even though the words are right and the accent is right, you're not in the right harmonic band, is the male or female, that those who were born in France are speaking in. So there's some things that are lost.
Yeah, no, that's true. In Germany, when I lived over there for a while, and what happened was, you know, if you're from Bayern or Bavaria, or you're from Norden, which is northern Germany, there's, you know, it's the same language. It all sounds the same. But boy, I'll tell you, the there was a huge difference in the way they communicated in their own language between, you know, Norden and Bayerisch down in Bavaria, which is the southern part. That was a wake up call. To me, it was the same. But boy, I'm telling you, they there was like a caste thing that went on, and sometimes they'd make comments that weren't so good. Oh, that guy's up north, you know, or this guy's from down south, you know, depending on where you were. It was really interesting. And then the other thing, when I was working in the intelligence community, I know that in some of it, this is why we could never get our intelligence people infiltrated so well with the terrorist groups, because I've worked a lot in terrorism over the years. That's actually the last 15 years I've been working quite a bit in intelligence with that for the United States government. But anyway, so in that process, well, I found out in Arabic, in these different languages that they speak, you can get the language down, but once again, have you ever heard Arabic? It's a strange language. It's very strange. It's even worse than Russian, you know.
Mm.
It's a very hard one. And so they never could get that intonation going in these schools back in Langley and at the farm to their people that were trying, even if they, you know, we just couldn't infiltrate because we couldn't get the sounds. And there's a lot of, you know, like in the Yiddish language, in the Jewish language, there's a lot of guttural stuff.
Right, right, yeah.
Yeah, and in the Arabic, multiply that, put that on steroids, and you got Arabic.
Wow.
And so that's why our government could never infiltrate Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah. Like MI5 was a little better at it than we were, but the best ones to do it was always the Jewish group, because the Jewish language is close, and they could infiltrate. So that's why we relied so much on Israel in the intelligence community for our intelligence, and the Israeli government, because their language is close enough to get in. And I think that's why the Arabs hate the Jews, because they can actually infiltrate their language barrier and get inside of them. You know, I mean, that's a whole other area that I've been working in. I don't really talk about much on the radio, but it's been a hell of a wake-up process for me, you know.
So, well, there's so many depths of things, and it still is getting back to sound.
It is. It's all about sound. It's
and
all about
overtones
sound.
And harmonics. And if people would get into that in some way, that they can, somewhere they could start where they won't approach it in the left brain way,
right,
they could feel the love of the universe spreading through their being as they start working with these numbers and these relationships. You begin to see the magical relationships occurring all over space, no matter whether it's through the microscope or the telescope.
Yeah.
And that's the world that I've been diving into, and it's become so fascinating. And looking at what kind of projects now with this knowledge can help things in the world be a better place, more loving, more resonant, with this kind of knowledge, and help wake that up in people in a world that typically there's many who have an investment in people feeling the separation so they can play off of that rather than the common ground that we all actually have.
Yeah. Now, on BBS Radio, we have a thing called Quick Chat, and that's where people from around the world send us emails.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions that came in, because I'm monitoring that, is please elaborate on instruments that can raise personal vibratory frequencies. So I'll let you handle that question to the audience at large out there. We did start to cover it a little bit, but I'll go into it a little bit more.
I got part of that, but that echoey distortion started happening, so
okay.
We must be getting into the interesting material here.
Yeah, we are. It says, please elaborate on instruments that can raise personal vibrational frequencies. You know,
well,
like we're talking about the sitar and that.
Well, certainly, you talk about those Indian instruments and such that have high overtone content. The gong is the most overtone content of probably any human-made instrument. It's a huge wall of sound. Gong.
Okay.
Especially
yeah.
Large symphonic gongs, in the 36 inches and larger. Smaller ones do, but those really large gongs have an entire wall of sound, even though they can have a fundamental and be tuned. So
yeah.
I've been doing a lot of work with gongs lately. And, of course, the Peisty Company makes gongs tuned to the different planet rotations based on Hans Cousteau's cosmic octave research, the Swiss scientist Hans Cousteau, C-O-U-S-T-O. But all of the acoustic instruments that have beautiful sound quality, all of the reeds, the woodwinds, brass instruments, all have that vibratory matrix. Now, some people may resonate for whatever the reasons are to stringed instruments, or maybe even within the strings, they'll resonate to cello, but they wouldn't resonate with violin as much, or maybe viola because it's in between.
Yeah,
so,
I've always loved the viola, as a matter of fact. I understand exactly what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, and there's different things, resonant factors in the body that make a difference. And according to bone densities and other things in a human and background, and probably a lot of DNA histories and things that produce a receptivity to certain pitch ranges and a receptivity to certain kinds of timbres, which also can trigger, be triggered from past life relationships to different instruments. That
I really like that. Are you, has any of your books got this information? This is brilliant what you're saying now.
Well, I do speak about these things when I talk, and at some point when I find out, you know, what really needs to be written, I'm happy to
write about it, but I
just speak about it on a need-to-know kind of basis.
Yeah, no, the past life thing and the structure of the bones, it all makes perfect sense. So I love it to have a guest on my show that makes me think, you know. It makes me, sends me off. I like to become the student. This is fun. So go ahead, let me interrupt. I just think that's really great points brought out, you know. It's awesome.
And look at the Tibetan instruments made out of like a femur bone of a past lama. You know, it's got their whole DNA. And when you sound that bone, you're sounding the Akashic records that being knew back into the field.
Wow.
Then another thing you get into, let's just take a look at the bells. The Tibetan bells that used to be made with alchemical knowledge of how to blend the metals together, and quartz and silver and other elements that were blended in, created these gorgeous tones like King Shah's and various Tibetan bells. Then as those bell masters died off, and they started making them in Nepal, the same bells...
Yeah, I got the seven metal bells. This is the best I got. The 12 ones are better, I guess, right?
Yeah. The main thing, there's different things with sevens and 12-ness that are both important, but if it's not made at the right time, the right pressures, the time of year, what's going on with the stars, the metal behavior is different under different celestial influences. And this has been proven scientifically, I mean, just from the point of view of printers having trouble with silver in their film development during certain phases of the moon, and they won't get good results, so a lot of printers won't print things during that time.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's how they began to tap into this. So all of the alchemical relationships of planets to metals, like Venus to copper, you know, and Jupiter to tin, Saturn to lead, the sun to gold, moon to silver, Mars to iron, all of those relationships are not something synthetic that some humans made up and just added those attributes. Those attributes are actually part of the workings of the planets from the subatomic all the way out into the solar system. There's direct things from the sun and gold, and a lot of reasons throughout ancient times.
Gold is such a fascinating subject, you know.
We spend a whole weekend talking just about gold what that means and the consciousness.
And we make a lot of products. You know, we make our receptors and projectors out of platinum. And
right.
We make them out of gold. And I know this when like Wesley Snipes is one of our clients, and he's also done BBS commercials for me. He has a platinum receptor. He's a martial artist, like the highest belt you could have. He wears that platinum receptor. If I put a platinum receptor on it, I might as well take speed, crystal meth. I can't handle it. It just speeds my whole metabolism up. I wear gold, which balances me. But
it has to do with that galvanic index, I think, you know, and platinum's up at the top of that. And how all the minerals fall down, all the way down underneath platinum at the top. And where somebody is on that galvanic index is probably a good indicator of how their body system can handle or would reject a certain metal combination.
Yeah, I mean, in martial arts,
theoretically.
I've seen this guy, you know, you see this, you know, like in the Blade movies, right?
Right.
Have you ever seen any of those?
Yes, I have.
Okay, you know how he runs up against the wall and then goes up on the ceiling and comes back down the other day?
He does that.
That's a real, it's not a stunt. He does a real, and I asked him, and he was here about a month ago, and I said, I said, Wesley, when you run up against a wall and you go up the wall and you go, your feet go on the ceiling and you come back down again, I said, how does that work? And he says, well, he can do it most of the time. He says, but there are bad days. He screws it up and he can't do it.
I consider Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon to be a training film.
Showing us
how to do these things that we know in our being.
Yeah.
Well, that's not answering, getting back to your...
I just had to throw that in somehow, you know? Kind of.
But this thing with timbres and musical instruments and pitches and, you know, and also there's different dimensions that instruments, like wood instruments that are woodwind, address certain kind of dimensional understandings. Rattles do a different whistle tones, metal...
like in clarinets, I won't play an ebonite of steel I only play wood.
Yeah.
It's just horrible in anything else, you know what I mean?
That same thing. Yes, I do. No, exactly. And the same with flute. Some will only have like a gold head joint on the flute, or they'll have an ebony piccolo with a silver head joint. You know,
wow.
I mean, the combination of woods and metals, again, we're dealing with earth elements, we're dealing with archetypes. And when these are put together in different ways, they address different aspects of the vibratory field, which touch into different dimensions. So drums open up certain dimensions and flutes open up different ones. Certain ones talk to the astral body, certain ones to the emotional body. So in response to the listener's question, is this whole matrix of things that is extremely deep?
Yeah, it is. I can see that.
And how it affects the psyche and how it affects the consciousness and what the tone quality is that Jimi Hendrix had on his guitar. If he played those same licks with a different tone quality, it would not necessarily achieve the same effect, even though he's bending the strings and doing the feedback. And you know, just to pick an example, or any of the other, let's say with electric guitar, is very specific tone qualities. The sax players, that all I can spot them, their tone, they play a couple notes, and generally I know who it is.
Wow.
That signature is important, very, very important in that, and people will resonate with that. You listen to Yo-Yo Ma play these amazing melodies because his cello tone is so perfected that it goes, it opens up another dimension because of the perfection of tone. And I think how that happens is not only the soul can come through, but the overtone mathematics has to be right in order to open the keys in these other dimensions. If you don't have the tone color right, that dimensional place won't open. And another one, of course, is all the how you tune these different instruments. So I've been paying attention to that. Like, people are doing work and gathering Tibetan bowls and bells, and I noticed a lot of them don't have the magical tone quality. And I don't generally want to fool with those, other than in a lightweight situation. Anything I take a lot more seriously, I want those tone qualities to be there. It's like night and day difference to me.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think that's amazing.
And we can get into some of these.
Well, let me give you an example of that. You know, I was a Benny Goodman fan, obviously, growing up, you know. But then when I heard Stranger, you know, on a Shore...
Yeah,
by Lester Acker Bilk. Yeah,
right.
Like, hello, this is how you play a clarinet. You know, not like Benny Goodman did. Benny Goodman was like a solar plexus player, and Bilk was like somewhere deep within the heart, as far as I was concerned.
Oh, you mean where Goodman played from?
Huh?
Where Benny Goodman played from? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he also treated his musicians badly, and did, you know, and so all of that shows up. There's no excuse for virtuosity and abusing musicians because one is a virtuoso.
Yeah, exactly. So,
you know,
that was
a worthwhile
point. Yeah. I mean, Lester Acker Bilk was like my hero in clarinet. If I could even, you know, play on his doorstep, you know, when he was around, it would have been amazing.
It's like spirit moved through his clarinet without effort, you know, that tone quality, even in a popular vein, which a lot of people would have discounted it because he wasn't playing jazz licks of a more mental meritorious nature, but that tone quality is spectacular.
Oh, yeah.
And you should also be able to judge a piano player on a grand piano playing one note, and all they can play is one note, and if they've really got it together, they can convey all the mastery with only one note and one attack. Madame Chaloff used to teach, who's taught a lot of people like Keith Jarrett and others, a master teacher on the piano. She could go over to the piano at point blank, put her finger on the piano, depress the key, and break the string.
Wow.
All by being able to control the energy, like chi energy, through her hand.
Yeah, I was going to say chi force. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember,
to what the listener was asking in terms of this resonances with instruments and all, where
the
person plays from.
As
a trumpet player, I got up to, you know, high G on the trumpet when I was in high school, when I was told, well, that's basically the ceiling. If you're going to be a high-note trumpet player and play lead trumpet and all, that's the note you had to hit. But then there's Maynard Ferguson and others who would go like an octave above that. And instead of practicing all the calisthenics and laying on an air mattress and blowing it up while I lay on it, all these things they did, I learned a particular breathing technique that liberated the blue fire in the cells in my body that I learned from a teacher who passed away, Bob Rasmussen. It's called Regenesis.
Yeah.
And by doing that breathing, without practicing, I went to that other register. On my way to the concert, I would do a certain breathing. I'd go to the concert, and I would be able to play a whole different octave on the trumpet without. In fact, a lot of the times I didn't practice. I just didn't tell people because they wouldn't believe me.
Yeah, no, I understand. I had a friend of mine, was one of my clarinet teachers. He plays in a band. His name is Bud Deal. He used to play with Duane Eddy, you know. This guy is like 70 years old, and he still doesn't look a day over 50. And he taught me how to play. You know, the clarinet only goes to a certain level, and he taught me to play the reed. And you still use the keys, but you're only playing the reed. You're octaves above where that clarinet goes. And I love to play up there. But, of course, a lot of people can't handle it because it's very high-frequency stuff. You know, I mean,
yeah, exactly.
I did that last night. My girlfriend's like freaking out. I mean, it's late at night and she wanted to sleep, and I'm out here and I just played the clarinet. As soon as I went off the, you know, off the reed, up on the reed, oh my God, you're killing me, you know. But you know, I love.
But
I love
she's
it
playing
when,
bass, right? So isn't
she
like
bass,
really
yeah,
tuned
exactly.
into that other register?
Yeah, you're right. She doesn't like it. You know, it was
yeah,
too much
and
for
her resonance. Why would she be attracted to? I mean, for a woman to be attracted to acoustic bass and pull it off and be in harmony with it, they have to have certain special attributes in their field because normally they don't go there.
Perfect. I mean, that's a brilliant. I'm going to bring that up. She's not here. Right. I'm going to bring that up.
You know,
tonight. I love it.
All the
I
women I knew
it.
That played trumpet, you know, they had to have extra special stuff together, and they were exceptional trumpet players. You know, there
yeah.
was something very, very different about them choosing that instrument. And this is not a sexist thing. You know, and when I was in high school, it wasn't popular for the males to play flute. But look at all the great jazz flute players, Hubert Laws, all of them are male flute players. You know, later on in life, they could deal with it. And that those the tone qualities are absolutely essential. Plus, whether or not it's something that's working with the breath, or it's working with skin, like a percussion instrument, with the hand,
yeah.
or mallets. You can see where this goes.
Yeah, no, I love, you know, you've got a heck of a deep understanding of music. I mean, you're phenomenal just talking to you. I think my listeners are probably blowing their socks off right now hearing all the things
well,
you're saying.
I had asked myself one question earlier on, and you know, when I was very in the heyday of my what I thought was just going to be my normal music career, it's like,
yeah.
how does sound really work? And all of a sudden, with that one question, I started getting into the nature of the single tone, the single note, how to sound, not just the relationships and the chords and the melodies and the rhythms and all of those other aspects of music, but how does sound really work? And then you get into how is reality created with sound, and that's what I'm immersed in. To me, that's one way of studying co-creation, is learn everything about how you create with sound, how do you create with light, how do you create with geometry and shapes represent certain signatures because of the resonance that's created through geometrical shape that creates sympathetic resonances. Even looking at certain objects, the resonance of that shape of that object will communicate to us in a deep way.
Yeah, yeah. Now I have a question for you. A lot of our listeners don't have computers because we've got air stations and satellite stations and stuff. How do people get a hold of you, and what kind of things do you offer? I mean, it's on the BBS radio website, but could you explain to people how
yeah,
to get a hold of you?
I have an email, which is universalsong@yahoo.com.
Okay, universalsong@yahoo.com, okay.
And they should put their phone number because I don't type fast enough and I like to respond back by phone a lot of the time. I have two websites, sacredwindchimes.com and sacredwindchimes.com. I have hanging wind chimes that are tuned, like I've converted geometric shapes into sound.
Yeah, would you talk about that a little bit? Because you've got some amazing products. We haven't even gotten to the products, the stuff you make yet.
I've done things like convert the actual frequencies of light through the rainbow into sound and the hydrogen spectral lines, and I've taken the platonic forms and other shapes and converted those into sound. So the wind chimes are completely different than what most people normally make for wind chimes. Then I have other types, like I do. I have tuning forks that are made to anything that anybody would want, ancient tuning systems, you name it, including I can take certain geometric shapes and convey everything in that geometric shape through tuning forks tuned to the harmonics of the geometry. So I put geometry and sound together and let the two talk to each other, and I've created a lot of products. I have a website called universalsong.net. That lists the tuning forks and another kind of chimes that I make that are called desktop chimes. They sit up in a frame and you play them with mallets, and they have like half-inch to 5/8-inch aluminum dowels that create the sound. And sacred geometry jewelry that's all tuned from different understandings of proportions and shapes and so on. We call it phiometry, actually, not sacred geometry, but phiometry, because it's built on a phi fractal universe. I mean, that's a whole discussion too. and then different sound CDs and products. We're doing some work on that website, so if it's the universalsong.net website is down, it's just being worked on.
I just clicked on that. I just saw that, yeah.
And so they can connect with me in that way. I've been slower in marketing things because I'm creating all the time, and it seems like the harder thing for me is marketing in that. I'm always getting the different creation ideas for the next thing and the next thing. So I'm getting more of the things that I've created, making them more readily available by just having to pay a lot more attention to that part of the business. But
yeah,
how are you doing with your business on the wind chimes and all that? Are you selling a lot of those or what?
That and the tuning forks and the different jewelry. All of those things are all part of what I would consider my own kind of sort of not so mysterious school. It's called the University of the Spheres.
Yeah.
And that involves geometry and color and light and sound and interacting with these different modalities and disciplines. And so all the products I create all come out of those understandings.
Yeah, because I don't know if you need any distributors, but...
I do, actually.
Paradigm would be great. When I come up to San Francisco, I'll talk to you about that. But
oh, that'd be fantastic. I'm like an R&D person. You know,
yeah.
I'm just coming up with stuff. It just doesn't stop unless I just turn off the switch.
Yeah. I like that exploration center thing here that you got on here, the pyramid with a band across it.
Mm. Yeah, that was as far as the geometry of the building that we're proposing, that was just for fun. We actually have completely different geometry that we don't have up on the web. But we were
Could
having
you explain
some,
about that whole deal, that whole group of people you're getting together. Some people out there may want to join this, you know.
They can email Gordon Lent, who's in charge. Gordon Lent at theexplorationcenter.org. Gordon Lent, L-E-N-T, at theexplorationcenter.org. And, you know, we're looking at putting together shows of consciousness and things that have the lasers and the lights and quadruple IMAX screens and consciousness behind it to bring all these modalities that has been discovered in the world and bring them together in a synergistic way that actually can create the kind of meaningful entertainment that is nurturing to the whole being. And out of this project, you know, we've got architectural designs that will, the acoustics that will support certain kind of phenomena happening because it's architecturally correct in the how of sound and shape, color, line, textures, placement on the earth. You know, there's a huge list of parameters that we're aware of that we include in our thinking that most architects don't fully go into.
I'm looking at, like, you've got Jeb Barton and on the board of directors and Leanna Hagen, and you got some amazing people here that are, I mean, this is not something like the pipe dream. You're really doing this.
Yeah, and there's others who aren't listed there. Absolutely. Because in looking at where the world is going, I feel we were born to rise to an occasion to be those beings we were really born to be. And
yeah.
I consider that even the beings, so I call the dimly lit, that are misbehaving with the environment and with people and such, underneath it all, they want to come into that light too, even though it scares them to death.
Yeah, and, right.
You know, but ultimately, it's so that they're included; they're not rejected. You know, they're easy enough to forgive them and include them and show them ways that everybody be taken care of. There's no need for any of the greed and all of those things at all. And we feel like there just isn't enough time left in the world to mess around with sitting on the fence and getting splinters. It's time to get our feet on the ground and show up being who we were really born to be.
Yeah, I agree. So that
and be loving and enjoy and have a good time and laugh and be natural beings. It's not like it's all serious, but taking it serious. Maybe it should be S-I-R-I-U-S, you know.
Yeah. Serious. I like that.
A higher vision of what this earth is supposed to be. So we've got a creation show that we're writing that shows where humanity comes from and a higher vision for what humanity was really destined to be and why the earth is such a precious place in the whole universe and that what goes on here has far more wide-ranging effects than people, most people even consider. It is not insignificant. And so we're addressing that in well-being and many different things.
No, I think it's beautiful. I love the colors on this, too.
What else is there to do? You know?
I know.
You know?
I know,
everything
I love
else, less, and if we diminish ourselves, it ultimately doesn't satisfy our soul, and we create a whole bunch of stuff that just becomes garbage. So.
Yeah, no, it's called theexplorationcenter.org, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Those of you, you need to go there, and at least I would recommend you go there and check it out, because I think it's an amazing website, and you've got a great program. And we talked, first time we ever spoke to each other, we were talking about that, and I want to get involved with that project too. You know, that's you're doing
and
a lot of cool
what you know
stuff.
With lasers and geometries that you've been shown, and those things are vital to what we're working with.
I can show you laser stuff way beyond anything you've seen so far. You know,
can you tune them down to the nanometer or the angstrom?
Yeah, that's what dye lasers do. You change that in my X1 healing machine. That was part of it, using dye lasers.
Mm-hmm.
You change the gas in them. You know, it's not like a solid state laser.
The
old gas lasers have a much better, I guess you could say, a timber to them than these new solid state lasers that are so cheap and all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can tune these old gas lasers, like if you had helium neon, which likes to run around 650 nanometers or 652.
Okay.
That's the old Nels Grid. I worked with them for years when they first developed them. They were one of my we were the first people to take crystals and shoot lasers into them and send it out to the world. There was three of us. Ivan, who did Lazarium over at the planetarium up there in Mount Wilson. And then there was my friend Fred Lord, who took it to Vegas, Las Vegas, and did all the shows over there, introduced lasers to them. And then me, taking the Mels Grid lasers. I've got a laser running here right now from Mel's. We're going to be off. So anyway, that's 20 years or 30 years old, still running. But you know what, Randy? We're running out of time here.
I want to thank you for inviting me and thank the listeners. And thank you so much. I have been wanting to connect with you for such a time. It's a real celebration, Fred.
Yeah, well, same here. And, you know, we're going to hook up, and I want to work with you on your products. And I really welcome you to BBS Radio. After the show's over, I want to have you on as a regular. You know, we'll have you on. Well, we can talk about things that we're working on. I want to have you as one of my regular people on here.
Well, thank you.
You
I totally welcome it. This is a real joy.
Yeah.
And I wish the best for all the listeners out there. That just goodness comes from the things that we're talking about. It actually contributes to quality in their lives.
Yeah, so go ahead, once again, before we close off the show, get out your phone number and all your information, and then we'll shut her down here for the day and let the next person come on, you know.
Okay, I'm at area code 831-662-2594. And you can reach me through Randy Masters at universalsong@yahoo.com for email. And do include your phone number so that I can phone and talk, because I'm really more into sound than typing.
Yeah, I don't blame you. And we'll all be up there together at San Francisco at the Cathedral Hill Hotel on May, I guess, pretty much
11th through the 14th.
Yeah, through the 14th. There's a lot of workshops afterwards. I'm going to be coming back here down on the 12th. And so we'll have a lot of fun up there. There's going to be a lot of people up there. We're going to, you know, a lot of famous people. Just going to
about 50 or 60 of the most famous working in sound all in one place.
Yeah, no, I think that's really cool. I was really surprised that I was hoping Justin would come over from the Moody Blues, but I don't think he quite got to, because him and John Lodge love this stuff. He's stuck down there in his Sir Lamar place in France. And, and Dave Gibbons, who's been on the show here. Matter of fact, David, after... you know, being on my show, he decided to have his own show on BBS. So he's got his own show now.
Oh, yeah, David Gibson's great.
Yeah,
we've been working together for over 20 years.
Yeah.
Doing sound.
So anyhow, our guest tonight was Randy Masters, and we really had a blast. That was the quickest hour and a half I've had in a while, and I hope everybody else enjoyed it. Hopefully we answered most of the questions on the Internet people asked. And you've been listening to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show, number one show on BBS Radio and number one show on the Internet. Until next Saturday night, God bless, and thank you for being here. Bye.